So why don't we start the meeting? We don't have a quorum yet, but it's past 12:30, so we'll start the meeting. And Assistant Commissioner Chuck Johnson is back to finish up. And again, would you state your name for the record? And but before we do that, we now have a quorum. And so I will call the meeting to order. And Representative Abler is going to approve the minutes.
They're outstanding, Mr.
Okay. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? The minutes are approved. And we'll now go to, I got a few other items here. Let's see. Okay, yeah, is Susie Giroux here? Or is, okay. She was just here a minute ago, and this is her last time she'll be at this committee. She's leaving for another job.
For real job.
Which I gave her a very good recommendation. And we have a new GOP researcher. Jason, why don't you introduce yourself? Tell us where you're from and what you've been doing.
My name is Jason Fossum. I live here in St. Paul. I grew up in southern Minnesota and I've been with the Republican caucus for a little over 4 years in a number of different positions and doing some health research.
Welcome to the committee.
Thanks.
Was I supposed to? Just another item. Representative Thiessen's committee is having an overview of health care reform proposals next Tuesday on the 30th, and he's having Senator Dernberger there and Peter Hutchison to talk about a number of things. And it would be, if you can get the time off, I mean, I'm on that committee, so I'll be there, but some members of this committee are not on that one, but if you can free the time up, that should be well worth your time. Okay, with that, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chuck Johnson, Assistant Commissioner of Children and Family Services for the Department of Human Services. Mr. Chair and members, we left off on page 49 of your budget book. This is a change item recommendation from the governor. The governor recommends repealing the sunset that is effective June 30th of 2007 for certain legal non-citizens under the MFIP program. Under federal law, there are certain non-citizens who we can't provide assistance to using federal dollars. Minnesota has, since the beginning of our MFIP program, provided benefits for those families using state dollars. That has, well, we've done it continuously. There's been many sunset dates that have been bought out over the course of the last 10 years or so. This recommendation would repeal the sunset, meaning we continue to provide benefits to these families in an ongoing fashion consistent with our policy to date. There are approximately 220 families who would be affected. This affects cash and, in some cases, food benefits for families. These are legal non-citizens, mostly lawful permanent residents who have been here less than 5 years. We believe that we should provide assistance to all Minnesotans who are here legally and eligible for our programs in order that those needs don't end up elsewhere in the community.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, the next page is page 50. This is also a change recommendation as part of the governor's budget related to the MFIP program. This is a change proposal that affects the, or that involves the time limit policy in MFIP and also the policy around intentional program violations, which is another way of saying fraud when somebody's identified to have committed fraud within one of our programs. This is sort of an unintended consequence of the way we set up our 60-month policy that we're trying to address. The 60-month policy, as I discussed yesterday, all families are limited to 60 months on assistance in Minnesota in their lifetime, and there are some extensions granted under certain circumstances. The way that those months are counted is we count any month in which the adult, the caregiver, the parent is on assistance, and that counts for their time clock. We don't count months for child-only cases. As I mentioned yesterday, those are mostly cases where the parent is on SSI, federal disability assistance. The kids end up being on MFIP in that case. We don't run a time clock on those cases because we don't have the same kind of work and time-limited expectations we do because of the nature of their disabilities. So that's the way we count months for the 6-month time limit. When someone commits fraud in our program, is found to have intentionally committed a program violation, there's a series of penalties that can be applied to the family and to the individual, and they involve disqualification from the program. In the first instance, if someone is found guilty of intentional program violation, they are disqualified from the program for a period of 12 months, second time 24 months, and the third time permanently. What happens then is that in the way our system looks at these cases, they become child-only cases because the parent is no longer receiving assistance. They've been disqualified, but the children often continue to receive assistance during the course of that time. What happens then is essentially a parent in a case where they have committed fraud can get what amounts to 12 additional months of assistance beyond another similarly situated case that didn't commit fraud and thus didn't get that 12 months of sort of the clock being stopped. This is an issue that's popped up a number of times in recent years, and we have decided to bring forward an initiative that would align that in a way that we would continue to count the months of assistance when the parent is disqualified due to an intentional program violation.
Representative Abler.
A couple of questions. One, does this require legislative action to change this, or is this something that the department can do?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, it does require legislative action because the way that the counting of months is done in the law, these folks are currently not counted.
And the second question is, are the children in children-only cases counted as part of the work percentage?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, no, they are not.
Okay, thank you.
Go ahead to the next page, then.
Mr. Chair, the next page is on page 51. This is a base level page. This is a page for support services grants. These are the dollars that are provided to counties for the purpose of providing work and other kinds of services to individuals, on the MFIP program, the Diversionary Work Program, and the Food Stamp Program. Most of the funding on this page is in what's called the MFIP Consolidated Fund. That's a fund of $111 million block grant that's allocated to the counties annually. That block grant was created in 2003 out of some previously existing sources of funding that were available to counties. These are the dollars the counties use to fund the administration of the program, provide the work services to individuals who are eligible, and also to provide emergency needs to individuals who have an emergent need, such as a housing crisis. In addition, on this page is a small amount of money for the Food Stamp Employment and Training Program. It's a federally required program. There's a chunk of federal money and a little bit of state money that we provide to counties to provide services to the food stamp individuals who are not on MFIP. The budget information for this is on page 54. Much of the money there, the federal money that's there, is TANF, our TANF dollars that go into the MFIP Consolidated Fund.
Okay. I represent Loffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Commissioner. Then we discussed at the last meeting how the responsibilities and the expectations of counties are increasing, and yet you weren't able to provide additional funds to counties to deal with that. If we chose that to recognize that with additional dollars, would this be the place where that would be appropriately inserted?
Mr. Chair, Representative Loffler, yes, that would probably make the most sense in terms of where to provide additional funds. Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, moving on to the next page, which is page 67. We're going to skip some pages now. We get into the child care pieces that are in Representative Slough's committee. Page 67 is a base level page, base level funding page for child support enforcement grants. The Minnesota Department of Human Services is responsible, along with the counties, for the enforcement of child support and running the federal Title 4D program, which enforces child support orders. This involves a number of different activities on the part of the state and the counties, including working with individuals to establish paternity, establishing and modifying court orders for support, whose child support or medical support or child care support, collecting and dispersing support, which is done through the state at a centralized payment center within our infrastructure at the department, and enforcing support orders, which includes a number of kind of tax intercepts, as well as enforcement in the terms of suspending driver's license, and similar kinds of steps that have been put into law over the course of time. The history of the child support program is it started really as an adjunct to the old AFDC program, that was a welfare program prior to TANF, really as a way to try to collect some additional revenue for when we had individuals on AFDC where the father, in most cases father, was not paying support. It has developed into a much larger program. You can see from the numbers in the upper right-hand corner, we serve about 250,000 cases annually in the program. Because the program also serves individuals who are not on public assistance if they come to the county and apply for services to get help with their child support payments. Mr. Chair, the budget information for this activity is on page 69. This includes the general fund dollars that the state disperses to counties to support their operations for child support. It does not include the state infrastructure for running the child support program, which we'll see later in the state and the department's administrative pages, nor does it include the federal passing dollars that counties earn for child support enforcement activities.
Commissioner Johnson, do you have any idea of the dollars that the support payments that this program actually collects?
Mr. Chair, it's about $600 million a year. We just went over the $600 million threshold this last year.
Thank you. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Huntley. Commissioner, on page 67 under services provided, the second bullet item talking about services provided by state and counties, and I know this might be a technical question and maybe out of your purview, but when it says establishing and modifying orders for child support, medical support, and child care support, does that have to go through the court system first, or can a father or mother make those changes without?
Mr. Chair and Representative Erickson, thank you. I didn't mention that when I was going through my overview. The courts are a very important part of this process, and the staff and the counties who work sort of mostly in the Human Services Department also work a lot with county attorneys and with the courts in the enforcement and establishment of orders. We tend to provide services to try to help the parents get together what they need, but it's ultimately the court that makes the decision on what the order level of the order is going to be and so forth.
Thank you.
Representative Loeffler.
Mr. Chairman and Assistant Mr. Johnson, I know a little bit about what counties do and dealing with this, but I'm not sure what the state does, and if it's centrally, and you said that was in another part of the budget. Could you at least just review what the state does? Are there certain cases that the state handles and the bulk is handled by the counties, or how are those responsibilities shared?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler, the state provides sort of two categories, I would say, of work in this. One is, and probably the primary thing, is that we run the PRISM system, which is the backbone of the computer system, which is the backbone that the counties use to operate the program. So all the county workers are the ones who are using the PRISM system in terms of entering the information and so forth, but it's actually the system is actually maintained by the state. We run it. We pay for the maintenance of that system and upgrades and so forth. That system does almost all of the actions that are involved in child support, including applying new policies like the new guidelines that went into effect on July 1, doing enforcement actions, and also, as I mentioned, all of the receipting of payments that come into a central payment center. We turn around and disperse those payments then to wherever they're supposed to go in terms of, particularly in cases where there's an obligor that has multiple child support obligations, there are certain rules about how much money goes which places. All that is done automatically through the state's piece of this. We also oversee the counties in terms of providing training and technical assistance, manuals and so forth for the county workers to use in delivering their program. We work with the counties on measuring performance and program improvement.
Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I notice we've got trend here for child support collection rates through 04. Do we have any data for 05, 06? Be interesting to see which direction that's going.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't believe we have the 05 data yet. I believe we're pretty close to having the 05 data, and I can check on that and see if we can get it to you. I would comment, since you pointed that out, that there's a a blip sort of in 02 there. There was a change made in how we counted child support collections, which we implemented in 2002 and then realized we hadn't done it quite right, and so we changed it the next year. And so it's actually been a pretty level picture the last several years.
Continue.
Mr. Chair.
Representative
Hodge. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just one quick question. From some of the dealings that I've had with trying to encourage counties to collect child support in some instances, I found that there's much more of a hesitancy for counties to pursue child support collections when a individual is not on public assistance. Could you let us know how we're dealing with that on a state level? And I apologize for my elementary question, but I am new on the committee. So,
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's fine. Certainly, any family that comes in and applies is eligible for services and should be eligible for the same level of services regardless of whether they're on public assistance. Certainly, there is variation across Minnesota counties in most of the services that we provide, and sometimes that's a strength of our system, and sometimes it can be not as much of a strength. I have heard something similar about individual counties because they have more of an interest, in a sense, in the public assistance cases. I don't know that we have a way of measuring to the extent to which that's true. I can certainly tell you in terms of what we do, that we, the policy that we put out there is very clear about serving all eligible cases and providing the same level of services, and it's very clear in terms of the performance we're measuring, that we're not just measuring performance on PA cases, but across all the cases that they're supposed to be serving. So I would also encourage you, if you're interested more in the topic, the legislative auditor did a study last year of child support, which looks a lot at the variation across counties and differences in how counties administer the program. It's another source of information. Mr. Chair, the next page is page 70. This is also a base level page covering children's services grants. Mr. Chair, members, this page covers a number of grants that we provide, mostly to counties, some to other entities as well. These grants cover child welfare services. In addition, on this page, there are grants for community children's mental health. When we reorganize the department, those grants are not within my area anymore. When Assistant Commissioner Wes Koister is here from Chemical Mental Health Services, he'll talk about that piece of it. So I'm just going to talk about the child welfare piece of these grants. The child welfare system, as I believe I mentioned in my introductory remarks yesterday, is a very county-based system in Minnesota, funded about half by county property tax dollars, about a third by federal dollars, and about a little less than 15% by state dollars. And most of that is represented here in terms of the dollars that flow through these individual grants. The system is focused on the safety, permanency, and well-being of children. Safety first, child protection services, identifying when there has been maltreatment of a child, providing services or intervening in the home in the appropriate way. Permanency, such that when children are removed from the home, and in cases where there's termination of parental rights, we do move as quickly as possible to get that child back into a loving family situation through adoptive or relative custody services. And also focusing on the greater well-being of children that we're serving within this system. We have a number of new initiatives we've put in place over the last several years here in the adoption area in child protection in terms of family assessment response, which is a new way of responding to cases of reported abuse or neglect where there's not imminent harm or egregious allegations against the child. In addition, American Indian Child Welfare Initiative, which we put in place 2 years ago, intended to help develop the capacity to deliver these services in tribal governments in Minnesota. And the Children's Justice Initiative, which is an initiative, it's a partnership between the department and the Minnesota Supreme Court to really work together between the social services side and the court side on how we ensure that we're doing the best we can when children come into the court situation, the child welfare system, to focus on the best outcome for that child and to do that in as timely a fashion as possible. Mr. Chair, the pledge.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Peterson.
Who pays for the, or what account does the guardian ad litem? Is that out of these accounts?
Mr. Chair, I don't believe so. That comes from the Supreme Court's by Representative Peterson.
Thank you.
Mr. Johnson, how does the targeted case management fit in with this page?
Mr. Chair, I will begin to do a change page in that in a second, but to give you a little bit of background, the targeted case management is a very key part of the services the counties provide within the child protection system. Targeted case management, the chair is referring to, for those of you who don't know, is a creation by the federal government from a number of years ago that essentially allowed states to access federal Medicaid dollars, a 50% reimbursement on our expenditures, for providing case management to targeted populations who are believed to be at risk of going into deeper end services, and case management was a way to try to keep them out. Minnesota and Minnesota counties and tribes have used this extensively in the child welfare system, the mental health system for both children and adults, and to a somewhat lesser extent for developmentally disabled populations. With the Deficit Reduction Act that was signed into law last year at the federal level, our ability to continue to get the reimbursement on those dollars is at great risk. We're waiting for federal regulations that will clarify that further. But that's a core of about $45 to $50 million that the counties use in the child protection area alone to provide, basically to fund the staff to do the basic work of working with families to try to bring services to them in order to keep the kid out of deeper end services or to make sure that the kid is safe. So this is very, very core service in this area.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, the budget information for this activity is on
page 7. Hold on a second there, Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Assistant Commissioner Johnson. Am I correct in understanding that on the targeted case management funds, this is the only area of MA where county funds, property tax funds, have been used to match the federal dollars in order to secure funding for this benefit?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, I can't make a definitive statement about all the financing options within Medicaid. This is certainly the one that I'm most aware of. I don't know, do you know of it? I'm getting a head shake from staff here. We can't think of any other place. That's why I think that's correct, Representative Loeffler.
Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to point out that this is sort of an area in which no good deed goes unpunished. And, I mean, not that the state had nothing to do with the federal decision, but when we were in tight, tight budgets, we violated a long-standing policy, which was decided back in, I think, the early 90s, which was that the income tax and sales tax should cover income maintenance, health care programs that are really determined by the economy, and that property taxes should support more property-based services. And there was a big deal, and it went through the tax committee to have the income maintenance takeover, where state funds would pick up the full cost of the federal match on all of those programs. And when the feds offered this opportunity to use targeted case management to deal with mental health, children's child welfare issues as a way to more comprehensively respond to those problems, counties would really be besieged by the closure of the regional treatment centers, and so we had a lot more people with serious mental health issues in our community. There's always pressure to do better in child protection, and so counties stepped up and offered to bring up the, to provide the match, because the state couldn't, so that we could access these federal dollars. Now when the federal government is sort of pulling out the rug, the counties are left in this, and I know the administration has at least a partial response to this, but I really think we should know that this was a major change from a long-term policy about what property taxes should pay for, what income taxes should pay for, and I think we need to revisit that as we deal with this issue and as we continue.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Johnson, you have on page 70 activity at a glance of up in a box in the on that page, and shows 8,000 children were determined to be abused or neglected. And you have out-of-home placements and then county-administered mental health services. Do you have these broken out in categories, as you mentioned here in your dialogue, something to do with American Indian child welfare, you know, people? Do you have it like in categories of low income, middle income, high income, those children, so a person can take a look at a broad spectrum of where the population is greatly affected by the situation?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I would have to check what kind of an income breakdown we have. Almost all of these children are very low income families. I'm not sure what other information we might collect not like our assistance programs where we collect a whole lot of information on families. These are kids that are coming in where there's a crisis situation, and we're dealing more with the child and their situation, and it's not really an eligibility basis. But I can check and see if we can identify any income information.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Johnson, I would like that information if I can. If you could get that to me, that'd be great.
Representative Abler.
What's that point?
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Abler for yielding here. And actually, Representative Anderson, they do have it by income and they do have it by race. And the different demographics throughout the state of the locations, Hennepin County is a heavy one. One of the things that you will find is the disproportionate amount of not just African American and Native American children that are impacted on this, but how individuals that don't have access to lawyers also has an impact in this. And so you'll see some of the data, and we can talk more about that if you want.
And then Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Huntley. Commissioner, are you able to provide us with the recipients of the child service grants, just a list of them and perhaps the amount that has gone to them, and whether or not you have followed through and have there been results?
Mr. Chair, Representative, you're referring to a list of the grant, like nonprofit grantees, non-county grantees.
Correct.
Yes, Representative Erickson, we could do that.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah, Representative Abler.
That's fine, not a problem. Actually, kind of a general question and a specific one, too. On page 73, you've got the breakout. And there's on the second line of numbers, you've got the base change, which Mr. Johnson, I presume that's for more cases. Is that, that's forecasted also, that's our caseload growth number, is that correct? The 3.9 million.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abel, that's on the change page I'm coming to next in the area of adoption assistance and relative custody assistance.
All right. So I'll just ask my question then, and I appreciate that. And there's nowhere to go with this, and I understand how expensive this whole department is, but there's a continuing philosophical divide question that goes on between the last governor and this governor, and that's to continue the same number forward implies that no costs have gone up for people doing the work. And I understand the growth in this niche, and I don't know how to fix the question, but as the department brings forward its recommendations, knowing the county costs have gone up and the change numbers are the same. I mean, the budget to date and next year, biennium and so on, is the same number per year. Do they expect that somehow the county's going to provide the same amount of service? Or do they realize the counties have to make some choices and they're going to have a little fall off of service, not having been given inflation?
Commissioner.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, certainly the department recognizes the counties are always making choices. As their costs are increasing, they're given additional responsibilities. In some cases, federal or state funding is going away that's been supporting them. The counties under law do have an obligation to provide these services, and so we expect that while they're balancing that, they're also making their best faith effort to do their part of carrying through the services, which means appropriating the appropriate amount of money to provide those services at the level needed. We try to measure this in the way that we measure county performance, ensure they're providing both on a compliance side and on a performance side the services they're supposed to, but recognize that the ability of counties to do that varies across the counties, and that it's a challenge certainly right now with the number of federal reductions that are potentially coming down the pike for counties coming into this fiscal year.
Mr. Chair. And actually, I was speaking more to the state's involvement, and I'm not criticizing except that it's a slight criticism, and I've been on this committee now, this is like my, I don't know what number of years I've set these budgets, but I see that, and it's a struggle, though. We've tried to have the bills to reduce county burdens so they could live on the same budget, knowing their costs go up, but the state also consistently, and not just you, but the people before you, come with a flat line budget. Knowing that the school does the same problem, I mean, they're all involved in very expensive business. So I should make sure you understand my point is that the state as well as the feds are doing some of the same kind of things. And we still do have a county-based system, which they do the best they can to meet. So you don't have to answer. Thanks.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, the next page is page 74. This is a change page, a recommendation from the governor. This relates to adoption assistance and relative custody assistance. The governor recommends a 5% payment increase effective the next fiscal year for the payments to 6,000 families who receive adoption assistance and 1,900 families who receive relative custody assistance. Adoption assistance and relative custody assistance are programs that we use to provide support to parents who are adopting kids who are within the child welfare system. Every year we have about 500 kids who have a transfer of custody because they've been through the child welfare system. We have about 1,600 kids right now who are in state guardianship. These are children who are essentially legally the children of the Commissioner of Human Services. They are state wards. They are our responsibility and our obligation for their future. And we are doing everything we've focused over the last several years really on trying to get these kids adopted as much as we can. And have had a great amount of success. Have 730 who were adopted in 2005. One of the tools that we use is adoption assistance. And this provides assistance to a family when it's adopting one of these children, both in terms of a basic payment, but also in terms of some special needs payments. Every child that we're talking about here is a child who's been abused or neglected, and over half of the children have some kind of a disability. So these are children with special needs where the family needs special help and some special assistance in order to adopt that child and give that child a future that they can have within a family that is better than what they find in long-term foster home or in some kind of an institution. Relative custody is similar. It's targeted a little bit differently at cases where there is a transfer of parental rights custody to a relative. And in that case, we also pay a monthly supplement to those families based on their income and what kind of income they have available. The payments for these programs, the payment amount that a family receives, have not been adjusted since 1990. And we're proposing a 5% increase in the payments in order that we can give a little bit of a boost to these families that are taking care of some of the kids that have the most needs and the greatest needs in Minnesota. In addition to proposing the payment increase, this page includes the forecasted change in dollars that we need to continue to operate the adoption assistance and relative custody assistance programs at their current levels. This program operates a lot like a forecasted program, but is not technically a forecasted program, so we actually have to come to you and request the new dollars that we need in order to keep ourselves funding at the current level within the current law. This includes, and for this next biennium, and actually an increase from our base in adoption assistance and a decrease in our base in relative custody assistance based on the new trends that we have in caseload. In addition, Mr. Chair, this page includes a request for 5 FTEs for the department for the operation of the adoption assistance program and for processing interstate compact adoptions. Adoption assistance, unlike a lot of our programs in Minnesota, is not a county-administered program. It is administered by staff at the Department of Human Services. We have about 10 staff right now who work in the program. We also have 4 staff who do interstate compact adoptions. These are both very labor-intensive kinds of efforts. We are currently funding these staff largely out of special revenue funds that we have that come to the department as federal reimbursement under the 4E program. That special revenue account is in structural deficit, meaning that we won't have the money to continue to pay for the staff that we have right now. So this request for 5 FTEs is essentially to keep the staffing level that we have. We need base level funding to have the stability in order to support this program. The adoption assistance program has grown from about 3,000 families in 2000 to 6,000 families today. So over that period of time, it's doubled without any additional administrative resources being provided to the department. We've also more than doubled the number of kids we're doing out-of-state adoptions for. This is every time a child who doesn't have a legal parent is moving across state lines. There's certain procedures each state needs to do to ensure that that is being handled properly and the adoption is being done properly, and the state office are the ones who manage that process. Again, it's a very labor-intensive process. We have 4 staff to do that now. We're requesting 2 staff for the interstate compact and 3 for the adoption assistance.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Assistant Commissioner Johnson. Is the payments that they get supposed to adequately cover the cost of caring for that child no matter what their age is, or do they have special access, for example, to get to near the top of the list on the Child Care Assistance Fund that you said has a 3,500-person waiting list? I'm just thinking, I know someone who adopted a set of 3 siblings who were special needs, and I just think of how that instantaneously blew up. I mean, what the child care budget accompanying that. I remember their shock at just what that did to the household food budget. And so I'm wondering if this is, does it vary, does the payment vary by the age of the child, or is it just a flat amount over the until that child achieves adulthood? Because I would think that would be a major barrier if we don't make sure that sort of the ancillary costs of those younger children are adequately covered.
Commissioner.
Mr. Representative Loeffler, the average payment in adoption assistance is $500 per child per month. And that payment it can vary by child depending on a calculation that has a base payment which varies by age and then also has a supplemental payment that varies by need. So there would be a higher payment in the supplement if the child has special needs that require additional kinds of costs. And I don't know, I can't exactly answer the question as to whether it meets all the needs, and I guess it would be in a lot of cases it doesn't. There's nothing within this payment that specifically addresses child care costs, and there's no special recognition given to these families in the child care assistance program. Some counties do use other dollars for child care, which they may target to some of these families. I'm not as sure about that. I think Aaron might be telling me. Mr. Chair, I was a little bit ahead of myself. Actually, they can. If they apply for child care assistance, it's not available. Then through the adoption program, we will pay subsidize their child care costs as part of as part of what we do to support them in taking on the adoptive children.
Great. Thank you.
Mr.
Chair, the budget information for this request is on page 76. You can see that it amounts to $3.4 million in the first year of the biennium and about $6.6 million in the second year of the biennium. Mr. Chair, the next page is page 77. This is a base level page. The Children and Community Services Grants. The bulk of what's on this page is the Child and Community Services Act. This is a block grant that goes to counties to support the services they provide, which are traditionally called social services. This includes much of what we just talked about in the children's area, children's services, child welfare, and so forth, but in addition, services in mental health, services to people with developmental disabilities, with other disabilities, to aging population, to adult protection, and so forth. So it's a wide range of services. It is a block grant where counties have discretion on how to use the dollars. The limitation on the discretion is that under current law, 40% of the dollars have to be used toward children. This act was created in 2003. It was created at that time of bringing together 15 separate categorical grants, putting them into a bigger block grant, reducing that amount by $25 million, and then creating the current block grant that we have here now called CCSA. So it was both an attempt to consolidate some of what was going on in this area and also, obviously, a budget savings that was put in place in 2003 when we were facing the deficit. Counties use these dollars in a variety of ways. That's reflected on the bottom of page 77. And as I said before, have broad flexibility in how they do that. We work with the counties in this one in terms of what we call a service agreement, and that is annually the counties provide to us, an agreement that shows how they are going to perform and what kind of improvements they're going to put in place on performing on measures of the child within the child welfare system. And then we oversee that progress under those service agreements. The dollar amount for this activity is about $100 million a year, consisting of both state and federal funds as well.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, the next page is a change page on page 81. Mr. Chair, members, this is the targeted case management that I discussed a little bit earlier. As I mentioned before, Minnesota is at risk under the Federal Deficit Reduction Act of losing up to $87 million annually in money that currently supports case management functions at the county level, as well as in some tribal programs. These dollars go for child welfare services to the amount of about $93 million currently, to adults with severe and persistent mental illness and to children with severe emotional disturbance. That's about $69 million a year. And to the vulnerable and developmentally disabled, about $11.7 million. Those numbers are in the middle of the page. Those are the total dollar numbers. These dollars come from counties spending the money and then getting reimbursed 50% by the federal government. The total here is $174 million. That's $87 million, the federal share that is at risk of being lost. The targeted case management, as we discussed earlier, has been in place now for 10, 12 years, but we're concerned when the federal regulations come out, and we don't have those regulations yet, that we will lose most or all of this money within our system. These are not services that are funded by the state, so I'm not talking about a hole in the state budget per se, but it is a big hole in our service infrastructure within the human services system at the county and at the tribal level. Within the child welfare system, this is a huge hit to their infrastructure in terms of the caseworkers who do the work with families, kids who have been reported for abuse, kids who have been removed from their homes. Providing case management services to line up the social service, educational services, health services they need in order to bring stability to that family, hopefully to put the family in a better place to care for the child, or when the child has been removed from the home, to move that child toward permanency. In the case of the mental health system, it's similar. These are case management services. It's sort of the social service part of what happens within the mental health system for those with severe and persistent mental illness and for kids with severe emotional disturbance. And similarly within the developmentally disabled population. What we're proposing here, given that we do not have the regulations and do not know what the exact impact is going to be of these cuts or what the timing is going to be of the cuts, a one-time $40 million pot of money, which would be distributed to affected counties and tribes once the regulations are issued and we determine that they will, in fact, have at least a $40 million impact on the state of Minnesota. We're also requesting authority that would allow us to use this money in either year of the biennium so that we could be prepared for the timing, whatever it might be, for when these federal regulations come. We'd anticipate that if the federal regulations are looking like we're expecting them to look, that we would be back with more permanent solutions at whatever point that becomes necessary.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Assistant Commissioner Johnson, you just, actually your last sentence answered my question for the most part. Not knowing how long it's going to take for us to get the exact number from the federal government, since we thought we were going to get that by the end of last year. And it is a wonderful step that the department and the governor is making with this one-time allocation. I'm curious to know what will happen or what type of discussions have been going on in the department for next year if we find out in June that we have more than a $40 million cut that the counties are going to be facing, and that takes up this one-time allocation, and next year is technically not a budget year. What type of conversations are having going on now, knowing the hardship that the counties will be facing, because this is mandates that we have put on them, in particular in this population, not just the state government but the federal government and their role and responsibility in taking care of our vulnerable population.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Walker, I can't speak with any certainty as to what we will or won't be doing next year in the legislative process, budget process, excuse me. I can say that we spent within my area of the department a couple of months this summer meeting with counties, tribes, people from the court system, and other stakeholders within the child welfare system to talk about the impact of the targeted case management reductions on the child welfare system and to try to devise a way to respond to those cuts. And we devised a proposal that we called the Child Safety Act, which would have inserted more state money into the child welfare system and would have worked more toward a performance-based system between us and the counties in terms of how we work with the counties, how we measure their performance, and how we pay them based on their performance improvement within the child welfare system. And we came to agreement on that, and it was sort of we had the solution before we had the problem, because we didn't have the regulations, we didn't have the impetus to move forward and say now is the time to do this. And so that's in part why we're coming forward this year with the temporary solution, is to say, until we know exactly what happens here, we want to wait to see what the response would be. I think that we are certainly cognizant that if the regulations come sometime before next legislative session, and if the impact is as severe as we're concerned it may be, that we're going to need to be looking at this as something that we do in the next legislative session.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for you, Mr. Chair, you've been following the impact that the cuts would have on us as a state, and particularly our counties, for members that have not been paying attention to this or following this as much, I encourage you to get educated on this particular issue. Your county will be impacted drastically. It's not that the children that are in our child welfare system are going away. Unfortunately, for multiple reasons, we're having more children throughout the state in various areas in particular come into the system more. And so this is, in many cases, your social workers are already impacted, having a large caseload depending on where your county is. And so this is the area that we're going to have to be watching, I believe, very closely over the next few months and going into the next year.
Well, Representative Walker, I think your county is losing something like $38 million.
Well, Mr. Chair, since you put it out there, yes.
And St. Louis County is losing, I think, $3.5 million. And, Representative Abler, can you tell us what an Oakland county is going to lose?
Was it about four? Yeah. Anyway, so, and thank you. If Mr. Johnson, can you tell me why there's, is anybody saying why the rules are so slow in coming and, like, why they'd be so slow and that from the feds, why they're
going? Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, we actually have no idea. As Representative Walker indicated, we had expected we'd see the regulations pretty quickly after the bill was signed, which I think was in February of last year. And there are several big areas of regulations that the CMS, which is the area of the federal department that deals with Medicaid, is sitting on right now, and we aren't getting any indication of what the timing is going to be. We heard this summer it would be yet this summer, so that seems like we're past that at this point.
Mr. Chair, in the kind of the solution mode here, has there been any effort to work with our U.S. the federal delegation, including the new very eager ones who were there, one of whom serve in the House, and one who used to be an attorney somewhere around town here, to get those folks to, with the new change in power, to put some pressure on? Has that effort been made at all to get those involved?
Mr. Chair and Representative Abel, I can't speak to what efforts counties may have been making. I'm aware that they have at least made contact with a number of the new members. From the State Department level, I'm not sure exactly what contact we made with the new members yet. I know that we just did another briefing recently of the delegation. I can't recall if it included new members or not, but this is an issue that we've kept in front of us since we first identified it in the Deficit Reduction Act sometime in 2005.
Mr. Chair, this might be an example where the state and the feds ought to, I mean, our own feds ought to get together, because, I mean, the irony of this whole thing is we're taking federal money to backfill a federal cut. So there is no savings, except part of the money is being squandered. They thought it would be used somewhere else, you know, or not squandered. But, and that fix itself is controversial and may or may not survive the process. So, just a thought.
Representative Leffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I think this is the time to talk about how things can get implemented retroactively, and you can have audit exceptions, and your counties can be on the line whether the regulations are out there or not, because the law has passed. The Deficit Reduction Act has passed. We just don't know how the federal bureaucracy is going to interpret that, because the law is fairly vague. And so we're awaiting regulations to know what the final impact will be, and you'll see very wide variations in estimates of cost, because if they interpret it narrowly, we have one impact, and if they go a very broad definition, we have a different impact. But counties are already dramatically reducing services. In Hennepin County, which is facing an unknown number that could be $16 million, it could be $25 million, it could be $38 million, very, you know, we have ranges of options. The county board has already cut $8 million in services and laid off staff because they feel that as a county they can't be liable for, you know, accumulating all this debt and having the feds come back and taking away the money for services that we're right now claiming federal match on. And so this is not something that is going to happen once the federal regulations get issued. That will just clarify the situation. The cutbacks in services are happening now, and I'm delighted that the administration is identifying this as a key issue, but I think we have to realize that right now there's major changes being implemented right now in our services for those families as well as for people with serious mental health challenges, and so it's not a thing in the future. It's happening right now.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, the next budget page is on page 82. This is a base page, relates to general assistance grants. general assistance program is Minnesota's cash assistance income support program for single individuals and childless couples, essentially those MFIP is for families. This is the program that's for the single individuals and childless couples. The program is eligibility for the program is in 15 different categories, all of which are sort of defined around either having some kind of a disability or illness that prevents you from working. So this is a program that's primarily focused on those who have some barrier that makes it unable for them to work. The program pays $203 a month for a single individual, $260 for a childless couple. We have about 14,000 individuals on general assistance right now. The program, many of these individuals on general assistance are eligible for SSI, the federal disability assistance, and we do have a project in place to work to try to get those individuals into SSI whenever we can, which is both better for them because the payment level is significantly higher and also better for us because it's federal rather than state dollars. This is 100% general fund state dollar activity.
What's the typical length of time it takes for somebody to get on SSI?
Mr. Chair, I was asked that question the other day and somebody's looking into the answer. It can take months and months and even as much as more than a year. Often the process involves applying, being denied, and then appealing, and it's on appeal that you actually then are found eligible. And so that process can be very long and laborious at times. Part of what we're trying to do with the project we have in place is to bring advocates in to work with individuals to try to shorten that period so they have all the information they need at the appropriate time to get their application in the best shape it can be when they first apply. It's up to 90 days for the first consideration, and then up to 2 years it goes into appeal and goes into the courts. So those are the sort of outside timelines of how long it can take.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, the next page is on page 85. This is also a base level activity. This is Minnesota Supplemental Aid Program, or MSA. Minnesota Supplemental Aid is a state-funded cash program that is paid as a supplement to people who are receiving SSI, that is, who are receiving the federal disability payment. MSA was created back in the 70s when the federal government combined several programs and created SSI. There was also a maintenance of effort requirement that required states who already had some kind of a program in place, which included Minnesota, to continue to provide supplementary benefits, and that's what we do through the MSA program. MSA is for individuals who are 65 or over, usually those who don't have Social Security, have very little Social Security, blind or severely impaired vision, or people who are disabled and over age 18. This is also a general fund, 100% state-funded activity.
Representative Leffler.
Mr. Chairman, Assistant Commissioner, as I understand it, I'm not real familiar with the ins and outs of this, but I understand that this is a key component of our being able to provide affordable housing for a whole variety of constituencies, that MSA is a contributor to their budget as we're looking for more people coming into the community. Am I correct in understanding that this is one of that housing component supports that we need to look at?
Commissioner.
Mr. Sheriff St. Lafla, I think the group residential housing that we're coming to next is probably more in that category. I'd ask if Janelle wants to address the issue of how MSA fits into housing.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Janelle Bush. I'm with the Department of Human Services. MSA is a program that can be used for some people leaving institutions. They will get an additional amount of MSA. It's called the Shelter Needy Amendment, and that permits the state to provide a small amount of additional money through the MSA program to help people move back into the community. And that's it was created about 4 years ago.
Thank you. I will say, Commissioner Johnson, that you have to hand it to the members here. We've been able to ask three questions that you needed help. And I didn't think that was ever going to happen.
Sure, I knew there was some connection there, but I knew Janelle would know the answer. Mr. Chair, the next page is group residential housing. That's on page 88. This is also a base level page. Group residential housing is a program that provides grants and income supplements to people for the room, board, and other related housing services. This is for people who have illnesses or disabilities that prevent them from living independently. So these are individuals who are eligible as individuals, but they also have to be living in a certain kind of licensed facility in order to receive the GRH payment. Those facilities are listed in the intro paragraph here. In DHS, we license adult foster homes. And then in addition, the Department of Health, who licenses board and lodging establishments, supervised living facilities, boarding care homes, and in some cases registered as housing with services establishments. Basically, what GRH does is it provides a payment to the facility to provide for the room and board of these individuals. And the individuals that we're serving here are people who are with mental retardation, mental illness, chemical dependency, physical disabilities, other developmental disabilities, and so forth. They're living in some kind of a licensed facility. The GRH payment covers the room and board. Often, these individuals are on SSI, so the GRH is only paying the increment above the SSI standard. The GRH standard is 737. The SSI, I believe, is something 580 or something like that. We only pay the increment above that. The SSI offsets the rest of those costs. GRH is 100% state-funded. We do have some individuals within GRH who are not SSI eligible but are eligible through GA. And in those cases, we also pay a supplementary service rate to offset the cost of the services that may be provided in that institution to the individuals. For most of the individuals who are on SSI, they're on medical assistance. And so the services are provided through medical assistance, through the waivers and so forth that support those different populations that I mentioned are eligible for the program. Mr. Chair,
if you go back over that, I mean, one of my questions is why is this not considered long-term care or continuing care?
Mr. Chair, in terms of where it's located
yeah.
and within the department, it's largely because it's an income supplement, and those are administered within my part of the department, and we use the MAXIS system. So a lot of the infrastructure is shared in common with some of the other assistance programs, how it's operated at the county through the state and county workers. That's a lot of why it is, you know, institutionally within our part of the department. We work very closely with the people in continuing care in this in terms of both looking at the service needs of individual around the licensing and kind of the general direction of where we're trying to go of getting individuals into the community-based setting, the least restrictive setting possible. So it's located in our part of the department for, it could be in either place, I suppose, but we work very closely with the people in continuing care on what we're doing within the GRH program. Mr. Chair, we are now moving to page 98. The next couple of pages that you'll be skipping over are ones that are in the jurisdiction of Representative Clark's committee. Mr. Chair, these activities cover the next two activity pages at the end of our section here cover the administration for Children and Family Services. The first activity is on page 101. This activity is called Children and Families Administration. This covers the portion of our administrative work that involves largely supporting the work that the counties do and doing policy development, program development, and policy interpretation kind of work. We provide training, oversight of what the counties do, develop manuals and instruction for them. We do policy interpretation in terms of what new policies coming down from the federal level, understanding what we need to change in state law, what we need to tell the counties need to change, and so forth. These folks also take the new legislation as it comes out of the legislature, turn it in, operationalize it, and implement it in terms of getting instructions out to the counties on the change and working with the systems on the changes they make. We also oversee and monitor grants with the activities that are funded in this area. Oversee our limited English proficiency activities. We assure compliance by the counties with using with running the programs that are under state law, and also quality assurance kinds of activities. This activity is funded by state and federal dollars. Like many of our programs, our administrative costs are shared between the state and the federal government, just as the program costs are shared.
Representative Loeffler.
Mr. Chairman and Assistant Commissioner Johnson, given that so many of the programs that support county services, and we are really a state-supervised, county-delivered system to a large degree, don't have increases, how will that impact the workload of this unit that's sending out instructional bulletins and, you know, new directives and updating things? I know at one time, I just feel like there needs to be a balance and change in program and expectations with the resources that are available for implementation.
Mr. Chair and Representative Laughlin, that's always a balancing act because we need to ensure that we are implementing whatever the law says we're supposed to be doing, whether it's federal law or state law. And neither we or the counties have a choice on what we do or don't do as long as it's within what the law needs to be done. We also try to work with the counties when we're working on implementation instructions to identify sort of the best way to do things and ways to put things into instruction that is going to be a way that the counties think they can actually implement. If they have ideas for how to do something more simply than we may have thought of how to do it, they have needs they think they might want our systems to do, which would make it easier for them to operate because the system will be doing some of the work for them. So part of that is trying to partner with the counties when we do implementation, particularly major projects, to get their input in how we're looking at the implementation of the project. Part of it is what happens in the legislative process as we and the counties go through trying to identify, as you're working on bills, are we going to be able to administer this? What's it going to take to administer this? Is there a simpler or more straightforward way to do it?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, the second page related to our administrative responsibilities is on page 103. This is called Children and Families Operations. This piece of our administrative activity largely consists of the computer systems that we have developed and continue to operate to support the services that largely are being provided by the counties out around Minnesota. We have three major systems within the Children and Family Services area. MAPSIS system, which is the Eligibility Benefit Determination Benefit Payment System for all the public assistance programs. It also does eligibility currently for our medical assistance program. We have the PRISM system, which supports all the infrastructure of the Child Support Enforcement Program. And we have the Social Services Information System, which supports children's services as well as, to a lesser extent, provides support for some of the other adult services that are provided within the social services area. Each of these systems is federally required and helps us in terms of meeting federal compliance requirements as well as reporting and so forth at that end. At the local level, these are all systems that are actually used by county workers, even though they are run by the state. It's the county workers who feed the information and use the systems to manage their daily caseloads, to make the payments, to get the benefits to individuals, and so forth. We also, I believe, in this activity have some of our quality control activities. We oversee, have quality control requirements under the Federal Food Stamp Act that we are responsible for overseeing county actions on cases, and that activity is within Children and Family Operations as well. Consistent with the last page on page 105, the financing here is consists of both general fund and federal funding.
Representative Loeffler.
Mr. Chairman and Assistant Commissioner Johnson, I'm just smiling because in my work in Hennepin County, where I'm a health policy analyst, I don't work with these systems, but I happen to be on an email list within the county where I get the alerts when the state systems are down and then the alerts when the state system is up, even though I have never had access to those systems and don't necessarily want that, but because they're complicated to learn. But I am amazed by how many of those emails I get, and so I would like you to add in your key measures for the future, the downtime for the system, response time, because the county efficiency is totally based on whether or not those systems are operational or not. And we all have worked with new computer systems. We know they all have bugs and you have things. But I am amazed with the volume of those emails I have gotten in the last year since they added me into that list. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Blockman. Mr. Chair, there's one additional page. Our last page is a change page. This is on page 106. This is a proposal that relates to the process of determining and redetermining eligibility for our public assistance programs and also for our health care programs for non-citizens. Currently, as of, I believe, 2002, state law requires that when an individual who is not a citizen applies for assistance in Minnesota, we have to send them to what's called the SAVE system. SAVE, which is Systematic Alien Verification Entitlement System, is a federal system which essentially identifies for non-citizens what immigration category they're in. And so it's a way to identify what someone's immigration status is or to identify whether they don't have an immigration status and may in fact not be here legally. We've been doing that with all applications for our program since 2002. This proposal would extend the use of the SAVE system to be done at recertification. In most programs, we recertify eligibility on an annual basis. This would have the at recertification would have the worker again run the names through the SAVE system to identify and ensure what the current immigration status of the individuals in the household is. This is a way to identify if there have been changes in household composition over the course of time to ensure that we're continuing to identify when to ensure that individuals are actually eligible for our programs. This is based on a recommendation that came from the legislative audit and report they did last year in looking at our eligibility processes around non-citizen populations. They had a number of recommendations. One of them was that we use the SAVE system at recertification as a way to ensure it was being used systematically over time with all of our programs. And this recommendation then aligns with that OLA recommendation. There are two costs here. One is every time we send a name to the SAVE system, it costs us something from the federal government. They bill us essentially per hits, and so by doing that recertification, we'll incur another $22,000 of cost. In addition, there's the cost of a half FTE here for healthcare operations. We administer the eligibility for the Minnesota Care operations within the Department of Human Services. In order to meet up with this workload, they would need another half FTE.
Representative Abler.
This is certainly the short version of this topic. We've had entire hearings about this whole thing. I remember reading one of the bulletins that somebody sent out that said, and I don't know if it's still valid, that the last question to be asked after you determine income and status, not counting immigrant status. The last question to be asked is immigrant status in the federal rules. Do you remember that? Is that still the situation?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure that I know
that. It was just a really interesting, curious thing that the last question was to check on that. But there would be some savings, too, would there not be, since some people wouldn't get coverage then? And is that, are those savings tracked somewhere else?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abel, we're not projecting any savings from this. Interestingly, the legislative auditor, and I haven't looked at it in a while, so I may not get this quite right, but they found that there were mistakes in something like half of the cases, but didn't find that any of those mistakes would have changed the actual eligibility determination that was made. So this is a way of trying to ensure that we're doing the right thing and to use the tools the federal government gives us. It hasn't, over time, proven to identify a lot of people who wouldn't actually be eligible for our programs.
Mr.
Representative Abler.
Mr. Johnson, just kind of, so we're going to fix a problem that's not there and it's going to look better to somebody? Is that kind of the...
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, we're ensuring that we have the system in place to identify. I'm not saying that there won't be anybody. I'm just saying that the numbers aren't very large and certainly not large enough for us to project the savings. And the auditor's report was a fairly small sample, but that was, in fact, what they found in the auditor's report.
I'll just stop now, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, that concludes my part of the budget.
Could you tell me, you probably have it on a pie chart back in the beginning here, but what's the total dollar amount per year in the budget stuff that you just...
Mr. Chair, it's a little over $1 billion. I think it was $1.1 billion in 06, and we're projecting about $1.2 billion in 07. That includes general fund and federal dollars for all the programs.
So the general fund would probably be closer to half that.
Mr. Chair, that is half. I don't know what off the top of my head.
You're good.
Mr. Chair, it requires me to add in my head. It looks like it's about $373 million of the $1.1 billion is general fund, and the remainder is federal. And there's some special revenue in there, which I'm not sure which that is.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler.
Actually, the question that I was too slow to ask last time, on page 38, and if there's more data that can be shown, I'd be happy, but there's a line item on the fourth or fifth one down, where end of session estimate, $56 million, and then $62 million, so total $119 million. Is that spelled out? Have we already heard about all those, or is that specified? That's like a pretty big accounting number. Just to have a single line. There must be a description of that somewhere.
And Mr. Chair, Barb.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Barb Julek, Department of Human Services. That line will be spelled out in each of the individual budget activity pages as well. My guess is it's probably tied to, it'll be tied to the forecast components. So it'll be tied to the MFIP grants and MFIP child care grants. And what this line is at the end of last session, it compares what was appropriated for 07 versus what was tracked for 08 and what was tracked for 09. So it just gets us to where we were last session.
Thank you. It's just a big accounting. Oh, by the way, $119 million. Thanks.
Okay, any other questions for Commissioner Johnson? Well, thank you then for your testimony.
Thank you.
Johnson. And Commissioner Coleman, do we would you prefer us to just hold you off so we start next whenever it is, Tuesday? Yeah. Why don't we wait then until next week, and it'll give us some time to digest what we just heard. And I'm sure the number, when I ask you at the end what's the total amount of general fund in your budget, will be somewhat larger than this one. So thank you. And the before we adjourn the meeting, there's a number of... do they all have flags? You all have flags in your books now, and we've marked certain pages in there for you. So with that, I will adjourn the meeting.